This episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/Sherlock. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Also, the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com. And the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetjournal.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, Episode 65, Art in the Blood.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became astrologer.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burt Walder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
And welcome once again to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
Yes, you are. And I'm Burt Walder. So there.
How about that? Yeah. Yes. And we welcome you once again into our little sanctum, our inner sanctum. Perhaps it's in your sanctum as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm pleased to be here once again, Burt. And I can't tell you how much
I know you can't, and I will tell you how much pleased I am to be here, but it just insert 20 minutes of conversation here, and well, then we'll pick it up as if nothing happened.
Yeah, I'm twice as pleased to be here because if you're listening, you're listening a little late because we had recorded this episode all the way back on June the, what was it, 2nd or so?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, June 2nd.
And yet that's not what you're listening to.
No.
You are listening to the version we're recording on June 16th.
Yes.
Because
it was so much fun that we decided just to do it all over again.
So nice. We recorded it twice.
Yeah.
Actually, no, we recorded it. Well, we did record it twice, but one crashed.
That's so right. It's almost as much fun as sort of repeating a grade in school. If you thought fifth grade was wonderful, think how joyful it will be the second time around.
Well, I wouldn't mind repeating the fifth grade if it were after, say, the 11th grade. But
that's true.
It's twice in a row. That's where it's more painful.
But
there was not pain this time around. I think we had a great time. And I think it was even better the second recording. So
yeah, I do too. And thanks to our guest for putting up with talking to us twice. But we're happy that he agreed to do so.
And we'll get to that.
We'll get to that in just a second, but before
we do that, we want to remind you of a couple of things. One is get in touch with us. Oh, leave us a review on iTunes. You can find us at bit.ly/IHearOfSherlock. I think that's the link, is it not?
Yes, bit.ly/IHearOfSherlock. Also, send us an email, comment@IHearOfSherlock.com. Go to our website where you can leave us a voice comment. Call us. 774-221-READ, 774-221-7323. You can
find
us every place. No pair of would-be raconteurs has been more available and interested in your thoughts and suggestions than the Laurel and Hardy of the world of Sherlock Holmes, Scott Monty and Burt Walder.
Wow, that's a new one. You know, I was just last weekend, I spoke at the Scintillation of Scions 7 conference in Maryland that was put on by Jacqueline Morris. And it was a really great little one-day seminar. I think there were about 9 speakers. I was introduced as one half of the I Hear of Sherlock team, and our show was called the Car Talk for Sherlockians. That got a great laugh.
Oh, I like that.
So I don't know if that was an intentional laugh or what, but clearly these were people who had listened to the show and couldn't believe it was being called something like that.
That's right. Don't read the canon like my brother.
Yes. Don't listen to the canon like my brother.
Yeah, that's right.
So we've got an exciting listener participation sweepstakes kind of thing we'll talk about after our interview, but it actually has to do with the person that we're interviewing. So stay tuned. Make sure you listen to the show all the way through, and we'll tell you a little bit more about how to win big here on I Hear Sherlock Everywhere. Coming at you right now, 7:15 in the morning, drive time. I've just killed any chance of having a DJ or voiceover career with that one. Mm. So we'll talk about that after we talk with our good friend, Tom.
Indeed. And we are very fortunate to have the incredibly patient Tom Richmond back with us today. Tom is an award-winning artist, a longstanding illustrator with Mad Magazine. And
yeah.
He is a little bit modest about, or at least doesn't go out of his way to tell you about his credentials, but he's been honored with several awards. He has been Caricaturist of the Year twice in 1998 and 1999 by the National Caricaturist Network. He has won the Rubin Award for Advertising Art three times and for Newspaper Illustration in 2009 from the National Cartoonist Society. And in 2011, he became the 34th president of the National Cartoonist Society, succeeding Jeff Keane. He is a remarkable artist, a caricaturist, a fascinating guy. He's also the author of a book, The Mad Art of Caricature, A Serious Guide to Drawing Funny Faces, which is available from Deadline Demon Publishing. And we're just delighted to welcome Tom Richmond to I Hear of Sherlock.
Well, Tom, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Well, you've been working on this for a long time, I know. in a number of ways, right?
Yes.
But, Tom, I know I had threatened you on email to make you part of the show a long time ago, and we've kind of danced all around it, but finally we have the opportunity and great reason to have you on.
Yeah, it's about looking forward to it. I've been looking forward to it.
It's going to be like deja vu, I swear. So tell us a little bit about your work. I mean, you, as we mentioned, you do work for Mad Magazine, but are you in a studio with the other zany madcap people, or are you working remotely? How does it work for you?
Well, sadly, it's not like the scene from The Simpsons where everybody's in the circus behind the door and Alfred E. Newman is dancing around. It isn't anything like that. All the artists and writers that work for Mad and have since the beginning are all freelance. So they don't have the creative folks in the offices. That's the editors and art department stuff, do the production and everything. That's Mad proper, but all of us, usual gang of idiots, as we are referred to, are all work out of our homes or studios or wherever. So I work in my basement, actually.
Wow. Nice and cool down there this time of year, I'd imagine.
It is. Well, you know, it's cool all during the year in Minnesota, but it's pleasantly cool this time of year, unlike other times of year where it's not pleasantly cool.
Yeah.
Do you miss it? Do you find it isolating? I mean, on the one hand, it's perfect for an illustrator because it's you and the work, right? And I would think anything else would be a distraction.
Well, to me, I've never done it any other way, so I don't have a frame of reference. I know some artists do really appreciate having other people around. You know, probably in a creative sense, it's great to see other people doing work too, and it kind of jazzes you up. But yeah, I think I would be distracted a lot by looking at what other people are doing and getting into conversations, and the next thing I know, half the day is gone. So it is kind of a bummer to be sort of locked away in a little room doing your thing. But on the other hand, you get to keep on task, I guess, a little bit more, and has its pros and cons.
So how do you actually find your inspiration given that kind of isolation? I mean, I've always pictured authors, cartoonists, artisans of some sort kind of sitting at a desk or a drafting table, almost banging their heads on it, saying, ideas, come to me, help me out here. Where do you find your inspiration?
Oh, well, I definitely look at the work of other artists, especially comics and cartooning, illustration too, just magazines. And of course, the internet's great for that. You don't have to go anywhere anymore. Get the whole world at your fingertips. But I used to, haunt the local comic book shop a lot and pick up things that caught my eye. And of course, Mad has got 60 years of stacks of old Mads laying around that I can always look over for inspiration. But and then becoming a member of the National Cartoonist Society too, it was a big deal for me because I got to meet a lot of my heroes and get introduced to cartoonists that, frankly, I'd never been exposed to their work before. And now I follow them, religiously. So the society was a big thing for me and getting to become more social with other cartoonists. And that's why I think when we do get together, like we did at the Rubin Awards a couple weeks ago, things tend to go crazy because we do spend most of our time locked up in little rooms. And when we get together, we have fun.
I can only imagine. And what a great bit to be able to put on I'm sure you don't fill out timesheets, but doing research, that comprises of looking at 60 back years of Mad magazines. I mean, boy, that's a rough life, let me tell you.
Yeah. Well, I get to write off, going to the movies.
Because, that's true.
I do movie satire. So, popcorn, no, can't write that off. But the ticket, I can.
And what for certain poses, some artists do this, for certain poses where they're finding it difficult to portray a character doing something or other. I mean, folks have been known to take pictures of themselves in those poses. Have you ever done any of that or gotten an expression by using a mirror and trying to put it on your own face first?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I've got a mirror sitting next to my drawing table. I use it a lot for hands. When I have to draw hands doing some particular gesture or something. It's just so much more convenient to be able to look at it, rather than trying to come up with it out of your head. But expressions, that's a great example because when you're trying to do a caricature of some actor, yelling or doing an expression and you don't have a picture of them doing that, you have to sort of project that particular expression onto their features. And the best way to do that is to see what happens to your face when you're yelling or, frowning or doing things like that. So I think all artists tend to base their own drawings on themselves first, especially hands. Like if you look at the hands I draw, they look like my hands. I got big knuckles and kind of knobby, gnarly hands, and that's all my characters have that.
Yeah, but and this is a good time to mention too that the August 2014 Mad is on the newsstands, and Tom has a terrific section in here on two defectives, and the gestures, the life that you put into the hand movements from a hand out to try to oppose someone, to someone with their thumbs up, to someone who's thinking. The animation of the hands is just magnificent.
Oh, thank you. The hands are very expressive, and especially when you're doing comics, you only have a single image to try to get across whatever emotion or whatever reaction that the person is. The character is supposed to be doing, and you have to use everything you've got. You have to use it. So hands are really important for that. You can't just do it with just the face. It's got to be body language. And that particular parody, too, is a great example of having to pay attention to how the characters, look and what they do in the particular media. So that was the TV show, HBO show True Detective, with Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. And if you've seen that show, Matthew McConaughey, especially his present-day character, The way he holds a cigarette is really, really unusual. He holds it with his thumb and his second finger, as opposed to his first finger. And he usually holds it so as the cigarette is above his hand, rather than have his hand, the cigarette below his hand. And then when he puts it up to his mouth, he uses the backside of his hand. It's really, really strange how he did that. And I noticed it right away. So I started, I really did a lot of that with him. Every time he's holding a cigarette, it's just this sort of weird, convoluted position. And it's noticing little things like that that's fun to capture, and hopefully somebody notices and go, oh, that's just the way he holds it.
It's really cool. And among other things, you've got, the great thing about your work and about a lot of the work in MAD is there's always a little surprise somewhere sneaking around the panel. And so there are guest appearances here by Ted Danson and Pogo Possum, which are.
Yeah, among others. Yeah, I snuck a few people in there. I think there was, there's a couple of MAD editors and art directors that are in that splash page. I threw them in there just for fun. I sometimes do that. I've drawn all my kids and movie parodies and my neighbors sometimes and different people I know just for fun, just to see if they're paying attention.
That's great. So noticing these details and getting a knack for picking up these mannerisms and whatnot, can you take us back and kind of give us a sense as to how you developed these skills and where you got your start and, how things led to where you are today?
Yeah, well, I always wanted to be an artist. I mean, I can't remember a time when I didn't want to be an artist, but I didn't know what kind of artist. I loved comics when I was a real little kid. Batman was my favorite character, but I loved Superman and all the superhero comics. And I thought, well, maybe I'd like to draw comics. And then when I got older, maybe I'd want to do album covers or, that kind of thing. So I really didn't have a clear direction as to what I wanted to do with my art. And then I got a job when I was in college drawing caricatures at a Six Flags park down near Chicago. And that sort of like was an epiphany for me because I fell in love with the art of caricature. And that's really how I learned to do it, was drawing every summer, all summer long, 3,000 or 4,000 faces each summer. And you get pretty good at it by practicing that much over the course of a long time.
Yeah.
And so when I got out of school, I thought, well, cartooning and humorous illustration is kind of where my strengths lie. I started pursuing that. I started doing some comic book work for a company called Now Comics, and they did a licensed property comic book called Married with Children, which was based on the TV show with Ed O'Neill and Katie Sagal and Christina Applegate. And I did caricatures of these guys. So it was very MAD-like, but it was a little bit more sort of like an animated version of them as opposed to real caricatures.
And you did the Coneheads too, didn't you, for Marvel?
Yeah, I did that. Actually, the work I did in Unmarried with Children sort of led to that. I kind of got known for doing likeness-orientated humor comics, which is a pretty small niche when you think about it. And so the Coneheads, they had the movie that came out in the early 90s, and they did sort of a sequel to it in a comic book form as a miniseries for Marvel, and I did the art for that. Which was a lot of fun. Got to draw caricatures of Dan Aykroyd and Jane Curtin and all those characters. It was certainly not boring. And that sort of led to magazine work, and I started doing work for any magazine that needed likenesses of people in a funny way were potential clients. And that's, almost anybody, because it's a beauty about caricatures that it's something that you have to have an artist do. You can't Photoshop a caricature if you don't know what you're doing or you don't have any idea what a caricature is about. And most magazines and most stories in media are about people. So, if they want a lighthearted approach, a caricature is a perfect thing. So I found that I was able to get, a fairly decent amount of work by concentrating on caricature as my main focus. And of course, I do a lot of work that isn't caricature as well, but I'm sort of known for that. So I get a lot of work that has to deal with funny likenesses of people. Mm.
And you designed one of Jeff Dunham's vent figures, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Jeff is a big Mad fan, and he contacted me and asked me if I would do some artwork for him. He wanted some sort of Mad-like versions of his characters for T-shirts and that sort of thing. So I did a number of illustrations for him for his products, and then he came to me once and he said, "How would you like to work with me on designing some characters?" So I actually worked on a couple different ones, but the only one that he ended up doing was his Ahmed Jr. caricature, the son of Ahmed. And Ahmed Jr. is the almost dead terrorist. He's not quite dead. He's mostly dead, mostly, but not all the way dead.
He was injured on Take Your Child to Work Day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it was a really interesting process because Jeff does all of his own sculpture. You know, he creates all of his own. I mean, he actually does. He makes the puppets. And so we kind of went back and forth, and he suggested some traits, you know, and I would do up some drawings, and we ended up with this design, and what he created is really, really cool and that really funny, and I think it's a permanent part of his act now. Well, so
I didn't know that he did his own sculpting. Does he start with clay and then do a mold?
Yep. He did. He would clay and carving, and he would mold it. But now he uses a 3D printer.
Oh, wow.
Of course. Yeah.
So you go from clay to the 3D printing.
Hmm. Yeah, I think he scans it. I think he still does the actual, at least I believe with Ahmed Jr. They did the Biography Channel did a special on him.
Jeff Dunham, saw that
the
recently.
Life of a Dummy.
Yeah.
And they showed the process of creating Ahmed Jr., and they showed it, the printer and everything. And I'm pretty sure he still did the sculpture the old-fashioned way and then scanned it.
Yeah.
And maybe he did some cleanup with it in ZBrush or something, or one of those 3D programs, and then he just printed it out in pieces and put it together. And I believe they showed some of my designs, actually.
Oh, I've got to go look at that.
They did. I saw that biography a couple of months ago. And when he showed the sketches of Ahmed Jr., I thought the style looked really familiar, and I couldn't quite put my finger on it. And now it makes a whole lot of sense.
Yep. Yeah, that was a fun job. I still occasionally do a little work for him. I haven't done any puppet design in a while, though.
Yeah, that is great.
Maybe one of the other characters we worked on he'll end up working up, but you never know.
That is very cool. So we talked a little bit about finding your inspiration today, but you know, I know one of the things that we've covered previously in our Lost recordings, we talked about Batman an awful lot.
Lost special.
Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, how Batman has played a role in your life? Because I think the interesting part for us is Batman can be linked to Sherlock Holmes in a number of ways, and we can cover those in a bit. But why don't you tell us a little bit about your association with the Caped Crusader?
Well, I was fascinated by him as a kid. I mean, very young kid. I was born in 1966, which was right when the Adam West TV show was on TV. So by the time I got old enough to watch TV, it was in syndication. And I mean, I would run around the house with a towel wrapped around my neck, you know, and my mom would sew me Batman hoods and things like that. And I just loved the character. My dad worked for a grocery store, and he would bring home comic books for me to read, and mostly Batman, Superman, Captain Marvel, those characters. I used to draw my own comics, and I mean, it was a huge gateway for me into storytelling and comic book storytelling. And then, you know, years later, I rediscovered Batman when I was in college, thanks to Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns miniseries back in the 80s, which was a huge thing that got a lot of that really brought comics into the mainstream, and it was one of the things that made comics cool again, you know, or at least critically acclaimed, where you could do some real serious storytelling with what was essentially a kid's concept. And you know, so I still love Batman, and I was lucky enough to get to do the parodies of the Christopher Nolan Batman films for Mad. In fact, I've never asked Mad if I could do anything before, but I did put some pressure on him to let me do the Batman movies. I actually sent him a picture of me age 5 in a Batman costume, and then me age 35 in a Batman costume.
The same one?
No, I don't have the original one that I wore when I was a kid, but the costume I have today, it's a movie quality prop costume.
Oh, wow.
That I had made by bought it in pieces from different artisans that make movie props and movie prop replicas. There's a whole culture of that sort of thing out there. Mm-hmm. And if you're familiar with the Batman films, it's what's called the Panther suit, which is the Val Kilmer Batman suit, not the one with the weird silver and everything all over it, but the classic black one with the oval symbol. And it's a pretty impressive looking thing. Whenever I pull it out and wear it, it looks pretty awesome. So. But I guess I scared those guys at Mad because they went ahead and let me do the parody.
That's good. Yeah, that would work.
Halloween must be a lot of fun at your house.
Yeah.
Well, that's what people say, what did you do with this thing? Well, I wore it around. I took my kids trick-or-treating in it, you know?
Yeah.
And which worked out great because I'd go up there and all the kids would get, you know, extra candy, and then I'd get a beer. So I came home with a pillowcase with like a six pack of beer in it by the time I was done, and the kids got their candy, so everybody was happy.
That's great.
But we still have people in the neighborhood that come looking for Batman. Now all my kids are all grown up. You know, my youngest son just graduated from high school last weekend. And so it's been a long time since I've been trick-or-treating, but I still put the suit on and hand out candy when the little kids come trick-or-treating. So we have kids that come looking for Batman every year, so I have to live up to the name and put the suit on. It's dreadfully uncomfortable. I can only wear it for about 3 hours before I'm stewing in it.
Oh, I can imagine.
Well, it's good that Commissioner Gordon doesn't call you more frequently.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's no big crime waves in suburban Minneapolis.
Thanks to you.
Maybe.
Thanks to you.
They just know I'm here, so they don't bother.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Sherlock Holmes fans obviously have their choice of Holmeses from over the years on television and movies and whatnot. So I have to ask you, Christian Bale, Val Kilmer, George Clooney, Michael Keaton, or Adam West?
Oh, boy. Well, I got to tell you that Adam West will always have a place in my heart. But I think the Nolan movies with Christian Bale were by far the best live-action adaptations of Batman. Mm. And none of them come anywhere close to the Bruce Timm, Paul Dini animated Batman. That's Batman incarnate, in my opinion, even though he's, you know, a cartoon. They just captured him perfectly. But I love the Nolan movies. They've got some issues, but overall, I think they were wonderfully done, and I thought Christian Bale was a great Batman.
All right. So enough about that Caped Crusader. Let's talk about the original Caped Crusader, if we can. That's one of my favorite movie posters is from Murder by Decree, Study and Terror from the 1960s, which came out around the same time as the Adam West Batman.
Yeah.
They show Sherlock Holmes brandishing a pistol and biff, pow, bam around the around the poster, and it said the original Caped Crusader.
That was John Neville, right? As Holmes.
John Neville, that's right. That's right.
Late 60s, yeah.
Tom, tell us a little bit about how you first met Sherlock Holmes.
Well, I sort of got around to him through audiobooks. one of the things I do a lot of in my studio is listen to, you know, music and things like that, because I spent a long hours at the drawing board. And I discovered that audiobooks were a great way for me to stay on task. I can only listen to them when I'm inking or painting or doing something that's a little bit less not creative, but when you're coming up with concepts and ideas.
It's more mechanical.
The inking and painting is more execution it. So you're not having to think about things. You're doing the things you've already come up with. And I found audiobooks were just a great way to stay on task for long periods of time doing this sort of stuff. And one day I thought, oh, you know what? I've never read the original Sherlock Holmes stories. I should get those in audiobooks. So I went to audible.com or wherever you get audiobooks from. And I, to my surprise, discovered that you couldn't just get the complete Sherlock Holmes on audiobook. It's like you had to buy the collections. There would be like little collections with a series of stories from maybe this, you know, the adventures, or maybe from memoirs. But there wasn't a complete canon. And I was shocked by that. I thought, why wouldn't anybody have done that before? So I started listening to them, and I really love the different portrayals of Holmes. I find fascinating by different voice actors, but one in particular really jumped out at me, and that was David Ian Davies, who had done individual Holmes stories and also had done a couple of the novels. He had done Hound of the Baskervilles, and he'd done The Valley of Fear, and I think actually did all four novels. And he was great at not only Holmes and Watson, but of course all those novels have got moments where they take you out of, you know, the Holmes area, at least the three of them do, and tell stories from other parts of the world and with different accents and stuff. And but I was just kind of surprised that he hadn't, or anybody hadn't, created this complete collection of Holmes stories. So I wrote him an email and I said, why not? and he answered me and he said, good question. And he ended up putting one together. So he does have now the complete Holmes canon that done in individual increments. I think there's 9 of them. And it's all in order. You know, being a comic book guy, everything has to be in order for me. Mm-hmm. You know, issue 1, issue 2, can't listen to them out of order. So he actually put it together for me. So now I get to listen to him read the canon whenever I want in my studio. So that's how I really got into the Holmes stories originally. And I still listen to them a lot.
That is stupendous.
Well, and Mad has a great history with Holmes all the way back to Mad number 7, which I can't remember what. I mean, it's somewhere in the 50s. But that was Will Elder's take on Holmes. And I'm assuming you must have seen that.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's one of my favorites. I don't think they've ever done any of the movies that I know of, but that was one of the original – that was back when Mad was a comic book as opposed to a magazine. And Harvey Kurtzman was heavily involved with everything, including the writing. I think he wrote like everything at that point. And that was a wonderful parody of the Holmes genre in general, not any of the movies in particular, but just Holmes, you know.
Yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes to it. It's Shermlock Sholmes. And I think Harvey did the cover of that issue.
Yep. Mm-hmm. He did all the covers. Well, not all the covers, but a lot of them back then. And that was a huge thing. And, you know, I still to this day, it's one of my favorite Mad pieces ever. Mm. And, then I got into doing a little Holmes art myself and, learning about some of the other media that Holmes has been in. I'm far from much of an expert on anything outside the canon, but I do enjoy some of the, TV shows and movies that they've done, over the years featuring the character. And It's pretty fascinating.
The comedy is great. You know, in those days, you know, it's just hard to express if you haven't seen it. But things that are so familiar to us today, you know, lampooning homes by making a complicated deduction that turns out to be wrong. And the way that Elder, you know, puts that in the strip so that he hits it once and then he hits it again. And Holmes' mannerisms, his excitement. I mean, to think this is all on the printed page mm-hmm. is just fabulous. And, of course, Watson is the sort of stereotypical Nigel Bruce-like character is beautifully done. And the fog and Professor Moriarty. I mean, everything is in here but the kitchen sink.
Yeah, they're pretty thorough when they do that sort of thing. That was one of Harvey Kurtzman's claims to fame, or one of the things he was best known for, was just being extremely meticulous and thorough when he would do anything. So, I mean, right down to what kind of buttons the soldiers wore in his war stories, you know, he was that meticulous about detail. So it didn't surprise me at all that when I actually got to learn, you know, and discovered Holmes and really learned the canon and the characters and how he was originally envisioned, that a lot of that stuff is very well done and noticeable in that parody.
That's great. Really cool. So when you got involved with the audiobooks and David Ian Davies, who, by the way, was actually on episode 40 of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. If you haven't taken the time to listen to that, folks, check it out. We'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. We had an opportunity to speak with David Ian Davies live as well, and he did a couple of paragraphs for us. Just as you say, Tom, it's just a sheer pleasure to listen to him narrate.
It really is.
But you also did some work for him there in terms of providing some art for him.
I did, yeah. He asked me to do a Holmes form for the audiobook covers, and I did just a headshot, not really a caricature. I intentionally didn't want it to be any particular actor, although I think it's probably got a lot of Basil Rathbone in it. Mm. And so sort of a generic version, or my version, a cartoon version of Holmes. And he used that for his audiobook cover. And I did another piece for him with Holmes sitting on an armchair with a few of his accessories around him, his violin and his boxing gloves. And
I love that one.
That was another sort of just cartoon version of Holmes. And yeah, and those are just fun little pieces that I did just for him and just for fun. He's given me a lot of hours of enjoyment listening to his recordings. And so I just thought that was a fun thing to do.
That's nice. That's nice. And then we actually have a number of these on hand, but at some point the artwork, like what you did with Jeff Dunham, was turned into a three-dimensional sculpture and made into a pen. How did that come about?
Yeah, well, David's son does work with a company that creates these resin-based products. They're like pens and different things, pins, and he said, "Would you mind if I gave your drawing here to my son and had some of his artists create it three-dimensionally?" And I thought, "Well, sure, that would be really interesting to see." Yeah. I mean, as a two-dimensional artist, I haven't done much sculpture in my time, just a few little things here and there. I was very curious to see how somebody would interpret one of my drawings, and then he created this prototype and sent it to me, and I couldn't believe it. I said, "Wow, this just looks like my drawing come to life." Unbelievable. So yeah, and they made a pen out of it, and you know, I think it's available on his website. I've got a copy of it right here in my studio.
Excellent. And we have a copy as well for one of our lucky listeners. If you stay tuned later in the show, we'll tell you exactly how you can try to win this very pen.
It's a pretty cool thing.
So in terms of you mentioned Rathbone being part of the influence that led to that work for David Ian Davies. But where else, you know, when you think of Sherlock Holmes, when perhaps you're listening to the stories or reading the stories, who pops into your mind and what other visual inspirations of Holmes have you had?
Well, of course, you can't I can't not mention Sidney Paget, you know, and the original illustrations, which, by the way, I Bert, I know you sent me a scan of the cover of a
Christie's catalog. Yeah.
Catalog.
What'd you think?
Oh, my gosh.
Isn't that something?
It was for, you know, the folks here listening. It was a scan of one of the original illustrations. And as you had said to me, I probably have never seen anything but a fourth or fifth generation copy, you know, in some book. It was absolutely beautiful. And it was done in a way that you can see how the work was done. You can see the white out that he used, and which was probably white watercolor or possibly gouache in, you know, with the inks. And I just sat there and stared at it for a while. It was
stunning, isn't it? It's stunning. Terrific. I mean, you look so for folks who are listening, this is the Christie's catalog, which has that archetypal illustration, iconic illustration of Holmes and Watson from Silver Blaze, where they're in the railroad car. And the magnificent thing about seeing this great photograph of it is you can see the wash work, you know, how faded and indistinct intentionally Watson is, how sharp and clear Holmes is, his fingers. And then the painting on the glass of the railway carriage, no smoking in that white gouache, you know, in reverse lettering. And you can see, as you say, how he put that on just, you know, at the last, you know, as he was sending it off to the publication. And you've just never, I mean, now it looks like somebody's work. And
it was fascinating to look at, especially, you know, since you're so familiar with that image, having seen it, you know, so many times, and then to see it and know that this was the piece that he created, you know, and there's only a little bit between you and the real thing. Yeah. And so you can really see his hands, you know, and how he worked the paper.
And little details like Holmes's spats, you know, he's wearing spats and the figure work, you know, the rendering and the proportion of the figure and the arms. And I mean, it's just really magnificent to see. It's an eye-opener.
Yeah, it was really fun. So that, you know, his illustrations are something that I think about a lot. And like I said, I never really watched too many of the shows or the movies until, you know, maybe in the last 5 or 6 years I started catching up on them. So my favorite is the Jeremy Brett Granada series. I mean, I know a lot of people cite him as the quintessential Holmes, and I have a hard time arguing with that. It really is a marvelous, marvelous show, and he is just so perfect in the role. It's hard to imagine somebody being better.
Yeah, and interesting, you know, Bert, you just mentioned the Paget illustration of Holmes and Watson in the rail car in front of the no smoking sign. It's a great scene. I think it's in the Greek Interpreter, where they're in a no smoking carriage and there's Brett lighting up.
You know, it's funny though about, I don't know if funny is the right word, but about artists looking at other artists' work. I mean, every year we pause and have a little lunch to commemorate Frederick Dorr Steele, Freddie Steele, who was the first great American illustrator of the Holmes stories. And somewhere in one of his memoirs, Steele, who died in the 1940s, but he was active in American illustration from 1905, you know, through the 1930s, and did the Collier's illustrations of Holmes. Somewhere in one of his memoirs, he points out that he went to an exhibition to see, among other things, a gallery program of the work of James Montgomery Flagg. I think it was Montgomery Flagg. And if not, it may have been Gibson, but it was some monumental American illustrator. And he noted in his memoir how cheered he was to see that the great man whose work he'd come to see occasionally had to cut things out and paste things in to fix an illustration, because immediately Steele himself felt less fallible.
Well, when you get the chance to see original artwork, especially from that era, you know, the 50s, 60s, 70s, commercial artwork was considered throwaway stuff. back then. They didn't think about it being something that you would hang on the wall, you know, someday. So some of that stuff looks like Frankenstein's monster, you know. It's just all pieced together, and all they cared about was how it reproduced. And I don't know if you're familiar with a company called IDW Publishing, but it's a comic book publisher out of California. And one of the things that they've started doing in the last few years is they are producing these giant coffee table artist edition books of old comics, like from the 40s and 50s and 60s. And one of the ones that they have is Mad. And what they do is they get the original art and they scan it, similar to that Paget illustration on the catalog, where they scan it warts and all. Mm. You know, all the little notes that are written, every pencil mark, the ring of coffee stain from the on the corner of the paper, the whole nine yards is included in these scans, and they're reproduced at the actual size the artwork was done on. Wow. And the paper they use has got a tooth to it, or is in some way at least reminiscent of the type of paper it was probably done on. And it's just so fascinating to see this stuff and see where these guys went in. And you can see where they cut some area out and then pasted in a piece like a puzzle piece to replace some face or something, you know, that they just didn't think was working for them. And they just go in there and work it, just like you know, somebody making a piece of furniture or something, and they just, you know, piece it together and send it off. It's really cool to see their hands, you know, that physical nature of what they do and how they work these surfaces. It's really, I just find it fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, there's been such a big cultural shift in the value of illustration. I mean, just look at Norman Rockwell. I mean, Rockwell was thrilled if after the fact, after one of his pieces of cover art would be sold for $100 or $200. And today, you know, thanks to Steven Spielberg and others, there's finally a dawning recognition of the importance of Rockwell's work. I think he would be astonished if he were alive today.
Yeah, and Rockwell's the perfect example of how that shift happened. I mean, he was probably the catalyst for that, where he bridged the gap between fine art and illustration, and he was creating those covers at a time when people who were who then became rich and had money for art were interested in hanging that sort of stuff on their wall. Mm. They were a lot more interested in something that had meaning to them from either their childhood or some aspect of their life, and having that on their wall as opposed to whether this person was considered a great artist by other people, you know? And that's how comic book work, in a way, has also become something that is sought after by collectors and hung on walls and in galleries and in museums now, because people like to look at things that had a cultural significance for them. Mm. You know, so, you know, Jack Kirby artwork from the 60s goes for tens of thousands of dollars.
You know?
Because people that grew up in that stuff are all like CEOs of communications companies now, making, you know, millions of dollars. And they like to have that stuff on their walls.
But, you know, it's funny and it's sad how much is lost. I mean, N.C. Wyeth, who was a great illustrator and the father of Andrew Wyeth, would typically get an artwork and was a terrific illustrator and did illustrations, beautiful color illustrations for things like Treasure Island and Robert Louis Stevenson. He would get the work back and he would paint over it and do something else.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying, is that there was no value given to that kind of artwork back in those days. You know, comic book companies and people that were publishing these things would routinely just throw out big piles of artwork. That's sort of why a guy like Bill Gaines, who was the original publisher of Mad, and he saved every single piece of illustration work that was ever done for the magazine.
Wow.
And nothing was ever thrown out. And then eventually they had some, you know, after his death and everything, they had some auctions, you know, Christie's and Sotheby's auctioned off some of this mad artwork from the, you know, 50s, and Wally Wood and Jack Davis and Bill Elder and Harvey Kurtzman, and this stuff was extremely valuable. You know, people loved it and they remembered it from their childhood, and it was also fantastic art. And so finally people started recognizing that that stuff was worth something. But it used to be thrown away routinely, sadly.
Crazy. Well, seeing as Holmes has managed to survive all this time from, you know, obviously from the time of Doyle and Paget all the way up to, you know, BBC and Benedict Cumberbatch and, of course, Johnny Lee Miller and the CBS Elementary. Mm-hmm. Or even the Warner Brothers Robert Downey Jr. series. What do you think is the reason that these stories and this character still stick with us?
Well, isn't that really amazing that something that was written well over 100 years ago still can capture the imagination of people today, considering how different the world is?
Yeah.
I was watching the BBC series, the Benedict Cumberbatch series, with my kids, who love it, by the way. And I'm watching it with my daughter, and we're in the episode, and I can't remember what they call the episodes. You know, they're always some clever play on an original title of one of the right. books or stories. And it's the story that where Holmes or where Watson goes after one of his buddies who's in a crack den, a crack house, right?
Right.
And so he goes in there looking for this guy. And I know that Holmes is going to be there because, you know, that's from the man with the crooked lip or the twisted lip.
Right.
And my daughter was absolutely floored when Holmes popped up. And I looked at her, and she looked at me, and she said, "You knew that was coming, didn't you?" And I said, "The person that wrote that scene did it 120 years ago.
Yeah. Right.
And you just were shocked and amazed by it. How incredible is that?"
Yeah.
That's the reason that he's still as popular today as he was before. Good stories are timeless. They really are.
That's the truth right there.
And great characters are timeless. And that's what Holmes is both.
Yeah, beautifully said, yeah.
Wow.
Good example. So,
that daughter, by the way, has been reading the canon now.
Smart girl.
Excellent.
Yeah. And she loves it. And yesterday for Father's Day, she got me this wonderful little DVD collection. It's not in front of me right now, but it's a little folder and it's full of Holmes, TV shows and movies and radio broadcasts over the years. So it's got a few, Basil Rathbone movies, some of his radio shows, some of the TV series that I'd never seen. So it's going to be fun to watch these things.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. I think you've got there the whole Ronald Howard BBC Sherlock series in that little set. That's great.
That'll be fun.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I was thrilled. So.
That is great. So related, you've come up with a limited edition print of Sherlock Holmes. And I have to say that this was inspired by a couple of earlier works that you did, one of which I own, by the way, and that was your multiple caricatures of the actors who played James Bond in the role. And you've done one now of Sherlock Holmes. Can you tell us a little bit about how these works came to be, and then we'll talk a little bit about the Sherlockian version?
Sure, yeah. Well, I came up with the concept when Bond had his 50th a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, wouldn't it be fun to do a series of caricature prints where the concept was, here's a single character that's been portrayed by multiple different actors, and do a lineup, you know, of all these actors in their various roles of the same character, but, you know, using caricature to sort of exaggerate or at least describe how they are different in the way that they portray them. So, and of course, through humor. So Bond was my first choice for doing that because of the 50th. But I have to admit, I'd always had Sherlock in the back of my head there. I'm like, I'm going to do a Sherlock here down the road, but we'll start with Bond. And it was a lot of fun. I did it. I sold it at a comic book convention at San Diego Comic-Con and then on my website, and sold out pretty quickly, actually. And it was, you know, it was a lot of fun to do. So then I thought, okay, well, I need another idea. Well, then the next year was Doctor Who's 50th. So I thought, okay, well, I guess I'll go with the same thing. So Doctor Who's kind of cheating because, yeah, it's the same character, but not really. You know, it's always the different real character. It's just the same guy. So I did 11 that time. And then, of course, I said, all right, that's it. I got to do Holmes. So then that was my third one that I just did this spring. So, but the problem, of course, with Holmes was both with Bond and Doctor Who, I could do all the depictions of them.
Right.
Couldn't do that unless I wanted to do a 300-foot print since there's been so many.
Yeah.
But so I did. I just decided to pick 8. And
how did you limit the, or how did you select the actual actors that would be just those 8?
Well, it wasn't very easy. I decided I'd come up with some criteria that I needed to apply to it. So one of them was I wanted to try to span the decades, and kind of give a timeline. So I'd start with a very early version of Holmes and then go all the way up to Benedict Cumberbatch would be my last one. And I also wanted him to sort of represent what I thought were either iconic depictions of Holmes or had some significance in some other way. Maybe it was an actor who was extremely famous for some other role, but would be very recognizable to even people who weren't, you know, particular Holmes fans.
Okay.
And my other criteria was I had to really like their depiction of him, so, or the movie that he was in. So those were my criteria. So I started researching and actually asked a few Sherlockian friends of mine who they'd like to see.
Hmm.
I knew that when this came out, I would be inundated with people complaining that this guy should have been in it and that guy should have been in it. But what can you do? You know, you can only pick so many. So do you want me to go through the ones I decided?
Yeah. Why don't you take us from left to right, oldest to newest?
All right. So the first two are just in black and white. And so the first one is Lon Chaney. No, not Lon Chaney Sr.
John Barrymore.
John Barrymore, who was in the silent film Sherlock Holmes in the 20s, followed by Basil Rathbone, and then Peter Cushing. And I did the Peter Cushing from the Hound of the Baskervilles film, the Hammer film, as opposed to the TV series he did in the 60s.
Okay.
So that's the 1950s, but I kind of included him in the 60s there as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then Christopher Plummer from Murder by Decree, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right.
And then I wanted to do one humorous one in there somewhere. So I picked Michael Caine from Without a Clue, who's just got a absolutely wonderful face. And I just really, of all the humorous Holmes films, I enjoyed that one the most, I think.
Yeah.
I liked how they flipped it on its ear, and Watson was the genius, and Holmes was just the hired gun.
John Watson, crime doctor.
Yeah, and I was trying to figure out if Remington Steele came before or after that, actually, because that's basically the same concept. I think it was after. So I think they might have gotten credit for that. And then Jeremy Brett, of course, and then Robert Downey Jr. From the recent films, and then Benedict Cumberbatch. So, I put in little touches in there. Tried to do some things that sort of related to their depictions of the character. So Michael Caine in particular, he's blowing bubbles in his pipe and he doesn't have any pants on. And Robert Downey Jr. is standing on a few books so that he can be tall enough to actually be Holmes. Because, you know, I enjoy those films for what they are, but I just can't can't get over Watson being taller than Holmes. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I threw a few accessories in the background for Sherlockians. So you've got the bent poker from the Speckled Band.
Mm-hmm.
And the Dancing Men on paper, and the Persian slipper with the tobacco in it, and the Napoleon bust from the Six Napoleons, and the severed ears in the cardboard box from the cardboard box, and then a few little chemicals in the background and that type of thing. So just some fun little touches for real Sherlockians.
That is great. And you offered... these are all sold out now, but you offered 8 very special limited edition prints where the lucky customer would get the actual main print as mm-hmm. well as one of the 8 original sketches that you did.
Right. Yeah, I did them in black and white using ink and brush, and then I color them on the computer. So these are just black and white. You know, it's sort of like comic book work where they're black and white, the originals. But yeah, so I did them individually, and then I offered the individual ones so whoever they could get their favorite. I did the same thing with Doctor Who, actually. All the Doctor Who's, they were 11 special edition prints with all the different Doctors individually. So and I believe you own one of those, do you not?
Yeah, I won the one that, or I bought the one that suits my personality the best, and that's the Michael Caine version with no pants.
Well, I told you that that is my favorite one.
Well, I'm pleased to know it now. I didn't know it before I purchased it, but that's really, really great to hear.
Yeah, it's just the best of the caricatures, I think. I love the expression on his face and... you know, he's just his deer stalker's on crooked, and his hair's a little messy,
the hairy legs and the garters. It's pure mad, you know. I mean,
yeah, very mad like.
That's great. Now, was there a lot of competition for certain characters here?
Well, actually, the Jeremy Brett one got claimed before I even sent it out. One of my friends, who's a big Sherlock fan, knew about this, and he asked me if I was going to be selling the originals, and I said yes. And he said, "Well, I get the Jeremy Brett." So I said, "All right." So I never even offered that one for sale on my blog. That by the time it was up, that one was already sold, I guess it's interesting to see the order in which they went, actually.
You remember at this point?
I do, yeah. Jeremy Brett was the one everybody asked about. That one was long gone. Basil Rathbone was the second one that went almost right away.
Hmm.
I kind of figured it would be Benedict Cumberbatch.
Right.
And actually, he sold towards the end. Robert Downey Jr. sold before he did.
Whoa.
The original. But actually Michael Caine went very last. You got the last one. And I thought, my favorite went last, but I guess that's okay. And I think Christopher, not Christopher Plummer.
Peter Cushing.
Peter Cushing went third, I think. And I think that was because there's like a Peter Cushing Appreciation Society on Facebook and online, and somebody there posted it, and somebody from there emailed me right away and got it.
That's great.
Yeah, but
well, it's a really, really fun and wonderful print. I think our listeners are just going to really enjoy it. We'll have a link up on the show notes as to how you can go about purchasing one for yourself. And as Tom lists on his site, it's $25, cheap. In that classic version. But we also we purchased an extra from Tom, and we will have that extra one to give away to one of our lucky listeners. So stay tuned. Later in the show, we'll tell you how you can win that as well. We interrupt this fascinating interview to bring you, well, the necessities, right? We have a podcast to put on. We have sponsors that want to be listened to, that want to be acknowledged by you, our faithful listeners. And as usual, we have our three fine sponsors back once again, starting with the Wessex Press, our longest sponsor. I mentioned I was at Scintillation 7 down in Maryland. I ran into Steve Doyle there, who was certainly not only hawking the wares of Wessex Press, which include their fine audio works like Voices in Baker Street and the Vincent Sterrett collection there, but also some of the newer works like the Vatican Cameo Mysteries by Anne Margaret Lewis and others like that. And of course, we mentioned the Klinger Reference Library series as well. Fantastic stuff. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, Steve had mentioned the Gillette to Brett 4 registration was open. And that is a show that is done about once every 3 or 4 years. I remember talking about Gillette to Brett 2, Electric Boogaloo, here on the show some years ago. But Gillette to Brett 4 is taking place in Indiana, Bloomington, Indiana, the weekend of September 12th, 2014. Registration is now open. And they just announced a special, special guest. None other than Mark Gatiss from Sherlock is going to be there on hand to talk, sign autographs, answer questions, etc. So it should be a really remarkable weekend there in Indiana. I won't be able to go myself, unfortunately. Bert, it's up to you to represent us.
I don't think I'm going to be able to go.
So I guess that means we're going to look for some audio contributors who are going to be there at Gillette to Brett 4. If you would be willing to report on it, let us know. Send us a note and let us know if you'd be willing to do that for us. And we'd be in your debt.
Yeah, we will. It'll be terrific. And
yeah,
that gets us to our second sponsor, the Baker Street Journal. And in fact, if you have the spring 2014 issue of the Baker Street Journal, which has Holmes on the cover at his chemistry table. On the back cover, you'll see one of the advertisements from Gillette to Brett 4, Basil, Benedict, and Beyond. And we would really be in your debt for coverage of the conference. I wish I could get there. I might be able to get there, but it is not looking very likely right now. But the spring issue of the Baker Street Journal is indicative of the terrific scholarship that this publication has brought to Sherlockians everywhere since 1946, with an update from Betsy Rosenblatt and others about the intellectual property issues surrounding Sherlock Holmes, which is timely because today was the day when the court's final affirmation of the ruling around the Free Sherlock case was widely distributed.
Excellent. Well, all that and more at BakerStreetJournal.com. And, of course, for you listeners of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, Audible.com is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial. How about that? To give you an opportunity to check out their audiobook service. Lots of book recommendations on there. If you go on and search for Sherlock, there are approximately 450 titles, but just go to audibletrial.com/Sherlock. Again, audibletrial.com/Sherlock for your free audiobook.
Yeah, and we've heard Tom Richmond say how important audiobooks have been to him. And if you love podcasts, then look, friends, your summer reading list must be getting higher and higher. It's June. How will you get through all those books? Well, the answer is audible.com. Just listen to audiobooks as you're mowing the lawn, cutting the grass, doing the laundry, wandering late in the evening under lampposts, staying away from traffic. It's your perfect method of consuming as much literature as you can possibly squeeze into your ears. Friends, today, looking your best is more important than ever. In our snap judgment society, you simply can't afford unsightly pimples and blemishes. That's why you need Kitty Winter Brand Facial Scrub. Only Kitty Winter Brand Facial Cleanser cleans deep, deep, deep. It's fast-acting, and it's attractively packaged in recyclable, easily concealed glass vials. Only Kitty Winter Brand Facial Exfoliant delivers the three C's of complete capillary cleansing. Ask for Kitty Winter Brand Facial Cleanser at your Sherlock Holmes brand product dealer today. Okie dokie. Well, now, back to our conversation with Tom.
You know, another fun thing with this print is, of course, when somebody wants to purchase one, there's a place for them to put in what they'd like me to personalize it.
Yeah.
And it's really...
You get a lot of that?
Oh, I do. And the it's the quotes from the stories that people want me to put in are very varied. And there's a lot of interesting ones.
What are some of the ones that you remember off the top of your head?
You would think that a lot of them would be, you know, the game is afoot and, mm-hmm. and sort of the classic ones. But there were a lot of really obscure ones. I'm trying to think about some of the ones that I've done. Now I'm on the spot and I can't come up with any of them.
But, well, while you're thinking of it, I'll tell you the one that I requested you to put on my print.
Okay.
And that was a singular set of people, Watson.
Oh, that's right.
Very good. Yeah.
Okay, I can I remember doing that one for you. I guess now there's a game. The Game is Afoot was a popular one, but
did you get any requests of people with non-canonical inscriptions that they requested?
Just maybe to somebody else. But okay. I remember one was to somebody. And then the quote was, to a great mind, nothing is little. And that's a good example of, you know, just some of the Holmes quotes that people would have. Another one was that I remember was, I may be on the side of angels, but don't think for one second that I am one of them.
Ah, nice.
So those are some pretty fun
that's great.
Ones.
So in your experience, either with some of the artists who've come before you at MAD, or perhaps some of the other folks that you've had the pleasure of meeting and getting to know, are there other MAD Sherlockians out there?
Yes, there are. I know of two for sure. Nick Meglin, who is a longtime editor of MAD, is a Sherlockian. And Duck Edwing... who's a cartoonist and a writer for MAD. He's done all sorts of things for them. He wrote a lot of Don Martin gags back in the day, and he wrote some Spy versus Spy stuff after Antonio Perhias passed away. And he also did his own one-pagers called Tales from the Duck Side that he drew. He's quite a Sherlockian, and we've actually communicated a bit on thinking about doing a project together. With the three of us, an original Holmes story of some kind. We had a MAD had its 60th anniversary a couple years ago, and we did a little MAD get together at the National Cartoonist Society Reuben Awards in Las Vegas, and Nick and Duck were both there. And Duck had just found out that I was a big fan of Sherlock, and so he challenged me to Sherlock trivia.
Oh, nice!
Right on the spot.
And wait! Did he know that you were the quiz up number two ranked Sherlock Holmes category winner?
There was no such thing as Quiz Up back then. This was pre-Quiz Up. But no, he didn't know how much of a Sherlockian I was, or whether he didn't know that I'd listened to the audiobooks possibly 100 times, over the last 5 or 6 years. So he started out with the first question, and I remember we only got one question into it before he gave up. So he said, his question was, in the Sign of the Four, Holmes, let's see, how did he phrase it? He said, Holmes enlists the help of a dog to trace the escaped criminal. And I said, Toby. Because I knew he was going to ask me the name of the dog. Nice. And he looked at me, goes, you win. And then a couple weeks later, afterwards, I get this big box in the mail from him. And he said, from one Sherlockian to another. And it was a plaster bust of Brett Spiner from The Next Generation as Holmes with the deerstalker on him and the collar and everything. And I've got it up in my studio. He sent it to me. I don't know where he got it, but it's just a really neat – it's like a full-size bust of Brett Spiner, Data as Sherlock.
Yeah.
And it's a fun thing. So,
that is great.
Actually, I've been lobbying Mad pretty hard to do a Sherlock parody.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just going to ask you about that.
Yeah, and I haven't gotten him to agree to do it yet, but I'm hoping that we can convince him to do it. Like maybe when, just before the next season of the BBC show comes out, or yeah. I don't know, maybe. When a season premieres of Elementary, if they do another one. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But what my concept that I'm pitching to them is to do a Sherlock versus Sherlock and have Benedict Cumberbatch and Johnny Lee Miller both racing to try to solve the same mystery and sort of mashing up, the two shows. And I think that would be pretty fun to do.
That would be phenomenal. Really would save some of the original artwork.
All right, I will. Yeah,
who knows?
Maybe I can convince them.
That would be great. Or if there's a place where our listeners could write in and convince them too, we'd be happy to accommodate that.
Well, I guess so. They've got an office in New York. The address is inside the cover of Mad every issue.
Yeah.
So. Call them and say and suggest I draw it because I'll be really sad if we have somebody else draw it.
Yeah, right. Exactly. No, this is a Tom Richmond commission. Has to be.
Yeah, I think they probably would just relinquish that honor to me, considering.
Of course.
They all know that I'm a fan.
Better. Well, if they didn't, you'd have to go by New York and throw that Brent Spiner bust through their window or something.
Oh man, that would be hard because they're like on the seventh floor. I don't think I could get it that high. But I'm sure that I'd get the nod on that one. I hope they relinquished on Batman. They'd have to relinquish on.
Yeah,
Batman.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Now, in addition to meeting up with some of your fellow Sherlockians in the Mad World, have you met up with any Sherlockians? Like, obviously you're out in Minnesota. You said, have you had an opportunity to go to the University of Minnesota library where the Sherlock Holmes collection is, or meet with the Norwegian explorers of Minneapolis?
I have not. I don't know why exactly. I just never got the opportunity. I did see, I think I saw that group, the Norwegian explorers. I think they've got a booth or a space at the Minnesota State Fair.
Ah.
Because we were going through the State Fair. And we ran across this big Holmes thing, and I think it might have been about the collection, been at the university, and that's when I found out about the collection. And I sat and talked to somebody there at the booth. I can't remember their name.
Well, but, I know Tim Johnson is the curator at University of Minnesota libraries specifically of the Sherlock Holmes collection. And speaking of state fairs, he has a blog that's called Special and Rare on a Stick. So,
well, that he could have been the guy. Then. That probably was him. Yeah.
Well, they should get their act together, and at the next state fair, if they want to do a Sherlock Holmes booth, They should have you there from your Six Flag days doing caricatures for people, but sure, only in Deerstalkers.
Yeah, there you go. It'd be all Holmes caricatures. So I'd throw in a lot of Victorian era stuff, and have them put in little accessories, and draw them in the Deerstalker and the Houndstooth. That'd be
well.
Fun.
I'll tell you what. Whether Tim is listening from University of Minnesota, or Julie or Dick from the Norwegian Explorers, get on this right away. This is a superb idea that Bert and I are giving away for free. No royalties.
And worth every penny.
Yes. Well, Tom, is there anything that we haven't covered or haven't asked you about that you wished we would have?
Boy, related to Sherlock, not really. I have always been felt like I'm sort of behind the curve on like the movies and the TV shows and things. So I've been really enjoying kind of trying to get caught up with that sort of stuff. But I think it's so neat that there's such a community of people out there that are big Sherlockians and have so much fun with the actual stories. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of fascinated with Victorian England in general, which was part of the reason why the Holmes stories captivated me at first. That historical period, I think, is just an amazing thing to study. And so I'm grateful that I've kind of learned a lot about the Sherlockian communities around here and around the world through you guys. And I've listened to many of your blogs. Ian Davies sent me the link to his, and that's how I discovered you guys, actually, and started listening. So your show is really a lot of fun, and I love to listen to it.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, this has certainly been a lot of fun for us.
Well, I'm glad to have been here. Thanks for inviting me.
You mentioned one question I had. You mentioned about the black and white illustration of the print. Is that your usual workflow? You still do pencil and ink by hand and then digitize to color?
I do. Mm. Yeah, I've tried to draw and ink on the computer. In fact, I did one Mad parody all on the computer from start to finish, and I hated the entire process. So I'm just kind of stuck in the world of physical drawing, where I love the tactile sensation of doing it. Yeah. The interaction between the pen and the paper, there's just something magical about that. I think you get removed from it working on the computer.
Yeah.
I've seen, don't get me wrong, I've seen some incredible work done on the computer where I don't care how it's done. When the work is fantastic, I enjoy it. But for me, I still love to dig out the pencil and the ink and have fun. Now, coloring, I love coloring on the computer. I love painting on the computer. I have no problems with that. And let me tell you, pixels are a lot easier to get out of your pants than paint.
Yeah.
But you don't get high from the markers that way.
It's true. It's true.
Well, it's the line. You can't get a line like Al Hirschfeld drew. Or maybe you can. I suppose if you started, if that's how you learned, I guess you could. But
I've seen it. I've seen people do digital inking that and drawing that. I can't tell that they didn't use real paper. I mean, what they did was phenomenal. Yeah. But for me, it just there's a disconnect for me, and I just don't enjoy it. So, I mean, the piece that I did for Mad was a parody of the TV show The Following, and I don't think very many people could tell the difference. In fact, I sort of quizzed my art director on it because he didn't know, and I said, I did something different with this one. What is it? And he said, well, I'm going to say that you inked it digitally, and I said, yep, that's right. And he said, the only reason I knew that was because you had mentioned that you did something different, and I zoomed in on it so tight that I could tell that there wasn't any fibers in the paper. The ink was just too clean. So, but just looking at it in the magazine, he couldn't tell the difference. Personally, I can't. I look at it and think, oh, yeah, it was a complete difference to me. But maybe it's just I'm too close to it,
Did it take you longer to do it all digitally, or about the same, or no difference?
I think ultimately, it took me about the same. Certain things are a lot faster to do it that way, but other things just take a lot longer. And maybe it's just because I, you know, wasn't used to working in that fashion, but I didn't save any time and I disliked the results. So I think that's kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah. But you're using a tablet?
I do. I use one of those Cintiq monitor things where you actually draw on the surface of the screen. So it's as close to real drawing as you can get. For years, though, I used one of those tablets that would be in your lap, you know, and then you'd look up at the screen and you weren't looking at your hand. Coloring inside, you know, comic book line work, that's okay. I can do that. But drawing, forget it. I couldn't even think about it. But when you can actually look at the happening on the screen right in front of you under your hand, then at least it comes close. But that's still not the same for me. But more power to the people that are all digital. Great for them.
All right. Excellent. Well, Tom, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us again.
My pleasure.
Well, I'm glad we got to do that conversation twice. I'm sad that our listeners only got to hear it once.
Yeah.
Or one version of it.
Yeah. Well, we covered a lot of ground. He's very thoughtful to allow us to take up so much of his time. And we will have links to some of the things that we mentioned in the show notes. Also, one of the things Tom didn't mention during our conversation is his appearance in his own personal appearance in comics by other artists. So, for example, some years ago, he was in the strip Pearls Before Swine, which is done by Stefan Pastis. And he then returned the favor by putting a caricature of Stefan Pastis in a 2006 issue of Mad. And we will put a link to that in the show notes. And some other wonderful things like that have happened. So it's really a thrill to be able to talk to someone like Tom, whose work we've admired for a long time.
Absolutely.
And by the way, if you have any interest in the art of Mad Magazine, there is a terrific collection put out by Watson Guptill some years ago called Mad Art, which is a visual celebration of all of the artists whose work has been featured in Mad over the years. And Tom is profiled prominently in there, and you can see more of his work as well as some of the other folks that we talked about, like Will Elder and Harvey Kurtzman. And,
well, that's superb.
And Duck Edwin. Yeah.
We'll have to put a link in there for everyone to check it out. Yeah. Well, speaking of links, we have lots of links to some of the latest newsy type things in the world of Sherlock Holmes. Of course, if you are not following along on a regular basis, we have a Flipboard and a Scoop-It. Both are apps that you can use on your tablet or smartphone. We also have them embedded on the site. You don't need to look at both because we post nearly the same links to each, but we recognize there are different user audiences with each. So check it out. Those are some of the things that we pull our monthly news reports from, but we try to keep an ongoing tally of what's going on in the world of Sherlock Holmes. And, of course, we have an audio recording of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, where the Klinger versus Conan Doyle estate arguments took place. You can actually listen to that. I believe it was just prior to episode 65, but it was also in one of our posts on the blog, where we've got an eyewitness account as well as the actual audio recording as well.
It's fascinating to hear that conversation.
It is.
Give and take among the attorneys. Yeah.
Particularly since Judge Posner, who actually is very hostile toward the counsel for the defense,
Well, I wouldn't say hostile. I would say properly skeptical.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, he was poking and prodding and looking for the reasoning behind their fighting this, and I don't think he was getting the answers.
Clearly, one thing that was happening was that the counsel for the other side was doing a lot of hand waving. And he frequently mentions, you know, you're drawing these circles in the air. And I noticed that went into the final opinion that came out today.
That's great. Well, Judge Posner actually, back in 2007, wrote a skeptical review of the new annotated Sherlock Holmes, edited by none other than Les Klinger. So I guess it's within his professional capacity to be a skeptic.
Yeah.
But we'll have the link up to the to that final opinion as well. Yeah. Of course, the Attaboy Clarence podcast, as long as we're talking about audio, features a full-length documentary that's dedicated to the Rathbone Bruce series and of both films and radio plays. You can check that out and check out that documentary on Spreaker.com. Again, we have the link right up there. We just missed Father's Day in terms of our publication date, but since this show takes place in June, it's worth mentioning that Father's Day just happened here in the United States. And to commemorate that, we've got a couple of things. One, we went through the Bowties Limited of Vermont catalog and looked for all of the bow ties that had some kind of canonical connection. That is, perhaps they were a word, a phrase, a character's name from the canon, and we pulled those out in one post on I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. Some 40-odd bow ties there to choose from. So lots of Sherlockian-related bow ties on the site with a link to the Bow Ties Limited catalog. And we did a Father's Day episode 2 years ago, I think it was, episode 43, Fathers in the Canon. And that is one that still holds up today. I listened to it a couple of weeks ago, and that was a fun show.
Yeah, it was a very fun show. Absolutely.
It was fun for us, anyway. I don't know if it was fun for you as a listener, but, you know, Bert and I had a good time. Yeah. That's all that matters, really.
That is all that matters. That's exactly right.
So those are both worth checking out in honor of Dads Everywhere. So I think we also had some listener comments this time around as well.
Oh, did we?
We did indeed.
Yes, and we had a listener comment from Beth Gallego. She comments, I was going to say something, and then I got to the pictures of the library, and I lost my train of thought. Oh, right. I was going to say that I loved the idea of a coffee table book of Sherlockians with their collections, something like Unpacking My Library, Writers and Their Books. Thanks for another great podcast. Well, thank you, Beth, for that comment. You're right, I think. That would be that's a nice title.
That is. That's interesting. Of course, you know, with Don and his collection, what was it, some 11,000 volumes, and those pictures he shared with us of his library. I mean, wow.
Yeah.
And I was actually just, as I went to that conference down in Maryland to Scintillations, I had the pleasure of staying with none other than our interview from, I think, episode four. Oh, no, six and seven. Peter Blau.
Ah, wonderful.
Stayed at Peter's house and saw his massive library. It's insane.
Really very is. Envious.
Maybe I'll do a post to share some of those photos.
Yeah, I would love to see that. That's a great idea.
You could see the harpoon up close. But while I was in Maryland at the conference, at Scintillations, I received a message in one of the manners that you suggested people get in touch with us, Bert.
Really? Did somebody write something on the back of a $5 bill and give it to you?
I wish.
Oh.
She. I don't think we had mentioned that version of how to get in touch with us yet.
Oh,
she was going off of an earlier episode. Can you guess which manner of communication she chose to?
A message in a bottle.
Yes. That's exactly right.
I know our listeners.
Yeah. This is from from Margaret McMahon.
Oh, good. Good for Margaret.
Yeah, Margaret, she cut a slit in a 1 liter water bottle, rolled up a note and put it in there with two little miniature crocheted deer stalkers. So one is coming your way, Bert.
Oh, that's wonderful.
But the note says, "Dear Bert and Scott, for years, I have enjoyed your podcast. You have brought terrific guests and introduced great books and projects. You have also been informative, thought-provoking, erudite, and entertaining. You've been gracious in your correspondence, and I have enjoyed exchanging emails with you. You've been waiting for a message in a bottle, so here it is. Please find enclosed a couple of tokens of my appreciation. I crocheted them from my own original pattern. Thank you for the podcast. Please keep them coming. Sincerely, your loyal listener, Margaret."
Well, that means a lot to me. Not the least is that now that we've received that, I can finally stop going down to the banks of the Raritan on Tuesdays and Thursdays looking for, you know, the offhand communication. Thank you, Margaret. That's great.
Yeah, and I'll post an image of the message as it was received and the crocheted deer stalkers, because they really are a nice little work of art. I think it was really thoughtful of Margaret to do that, and just really ingenious, the design that she put together. Just in, we promised you that you alone could win or potentially win one of two prizes that we're offering here. And those prizes were what again, Bert?
Those prizes were a fabulous Sherlock Holmes pen, the artwork of Tom Richmond brought brilliantly to life by the son of David Ian Davies.
Yes.
And a magnificent print of the eight actors who we talked with Tom earlier about their portrayals of Sherlock Holmes, including Scott's favorite, Michael Caine.
Yes.
All this can be yours. But how? How? I hear you cry.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think the way we'll go about it is we will select the most interesting comments about our episode here with Tom, but you have to hashtag it IHOS65. That's IHOS, the number 65, in whatever conveyance you wish to communicate with us. Could be an email, could be a Facebook comment, could be a comment on the blog, could be a tweet. We need you to hashtag IHOS65 with some sort of pithy observation, perhaps about your favorite Sherlock Holmes and your favorite Sherlock Holmes interpretation. Who was it and why? IHOS65 hashtag.
Excellent.
And we will keep this contest open until, well, let's say until the end of August, just to give people time.
Yeah, and how many winners will we have?
We'll have two. We'll have a primary winner who will win the print and a runner-up who will win the pen.
Excellent.
That sounds fair. But again, remember, tell us who your favorite interpretation of Sherlock Holmes was by and why. Hashtag IHOS65.
Excellent. I hope you feel better.
You know what that means.
Yes, yes.
Time to blow off some steam, some gas, as it were. And this time, the editor's gas lamp is actually an editor's gas lamp. I know we've fluctuated from time to time. But in this case, we've returned to the original. Volume 8, number 2, from April 1958, as penned by none other than Edgar Smith himself. And it is appropriately entitled, Art in the Blood. "Art in the Blood," said Mr. Sherlock Holmes, "is liable to take the strangest forms. The forms the master's own art took in practice and proclivity were not, it's pleasant to note, so very strange after all. Why, he loved good music, and his tastes were usually simple. The solid fare of Mendelssohn, Meyerbeer, Offenbach, and Wagner for his routine wants. Or, when an academic mood was upon him, the recondite motets of Orlando di Lasso. In painting, he admired, if he did not actually covet, at least two works by Jean-Baptiste Greuze. And he was partial, surely, to the delicate creations of his own great-uncle and his first cousin once removed. And in the field of literature, he showed a cultivated and discriminating taste. The writings of Shakespeare, whom he paraphrased tellingly on at least two occasions. The Bible, which he was rusty but resourceful. Thomas Carlyle, whom he denied and then quoted, and across the borders of language, such stalwarts as Goethe, Flaubert, Hafiz, and Horace. These are not strange bents, and Holmes's blood, like his brother Mycroft, maintained its artistic normality in all but the course it took toward endowing him with a particular or peculiar faculty for observation and deduction. But think, what a painful situation might confront us if the detective had not, in fact, kept his artistic blood under control and his artistic feet on the ground. It's inconceivable, of course, but let us just assume that he had been exposed to some of the influences that are prevalent in the field of the arts today, and that he had yielded to their blandishments. We would see him in this phantasmagoria, sitting in the stalls, wrapped in the most perfect happiness, gently waving his long, thin fingers as he listened with languid, dreamy eyes to the frightful cacophony of bar talk, and murmuring, "His dissonances and atonality are splendid, Watson." Or we would hear him expatiating to his friend as he looked at the catalog of the latest Portalis sale. "Modern criticism has more than endorsed the high opinion formed of Klee by his contemporaries. His rendering of Slaughter in Limehouse number 87 reveals the very depths of this great man's mood, and his comic perception is all the more devastating because it was discovered later that the painting was hung upside down." Or, as he philosophized on the ways of a woman at the conclusion of Mary Sutherland's little case, "Snatch whoso snatches delusion from a woman deluded, also snatching angerbite of inwit, oh, dangerous snatch, for a tiger cub is a tiger cub is a tiger cub." There is as much sense in James Joyce as there is in Gertrude Stein, and as much knowledge of the world. No. This is Sherlock Holmes we are thinking of, after all. And the art in his blood has not, thank goodness, been spilled upon the floor of our nightmares.
Wonderful.
Indeed. So I guess that about wraps it up. That squeezes every last bit of energy and patience that our listeners have, I'm sure.
I wouldn't be at all surprised. Yes, yes. Well, we've given them plenty of content, and it's a good kickoff for these warmer summer months when people can hopefully relax a little bit and do some serious thinking about Sherlock Holmes.
So, or at least fall asleep on the beach to our voices.
Yes, even better.
That works too.
Well, the only thing left then is for you to observe that you're Scott Monte.
And for you to take home that you are Bert Walder.
I refuse.
Oh, please don't.
But together we say, the game's afoot.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.